Okay, so hello everybody. So just thought to do a short introduction to the retreat with a few retreat guidelines. Is this anybody's first retreat, or has everybody been on a retreat? Yeah. Your first retreat? A few people's? Yeah? Okay, great. So so this is, you know, I'm actually, as far as retreat leaders or go or meditator, I'm kind of a relaxed person. So no worries. During a retreat, I remember on my first retreat, going there and not really knowing what I was getting into, and sitting down to meditate, and all of a sudden, you know, this kind of quiet descends, and you know, you feel kind of really nervous to move at all, and sometimes can even get these kind of thoughts coming back in your head, like, oh, this person's a really excellent meditator. You know, what am I? You know, I'm not up to this level. I can't meditate here. But, you know, no worries about all that. Basically, we all have kind of different bodies, you know, different, you know, maybe people have had injuries in the past. So if you need to move at any time, please feel free to shift your posture. If you need to move from the floor to a chair, please feel free. And if there aren't enough chairs, there's more back there. You're welcome to grab one. And then also often retreats are conducted in silence. So this doesn't mean that no talking at all, as in, you know, you can't say anything to anybody. But basically what we try to limit our speech to is only the necessary speech. So more or less, like if we need to know where something goes or where the washroom is or things like that, then that's, you know, totally fine. But just to kind of respect other people's desire to practice, we try to keep our speech to a minimum. Actually, I remember at the first retreats I go to, it was totally silent, so you'd end up kind of writing these notes. But here, you know, you can talk, but just for that that kind of purpose would be good. And I think that's pretty much it. At about 10:30, We'll meet in here again, and there'll be more announcements. We're going to try to do a pindapat. So this is the first time I've tried to do this at a temple, but we'll see how it all goes. And so there'll be more instructions on that. So as far as let's get this off of here. So as far as practicing meditation on a retreat setting goes, the basic idea is that for the duration of this day, we turn everybody into kind of monks, you know. So from 9 to 5 for a working day, you get the chance to see what it's like to be a kind of monk or a nun in a kind of forest monastery, kind of place devoted to meditation. And so meditation was actually one of the, this is kind of main work that the Buddha recommended for his monks. When you see in the canon all these kind of wonderful things that come from people's practice, the Buddha's recommendation all the time is, okay, after your alms round, go back to the root of the tree you were staying in and practice meditation for the whole day. And also on your alms round, don't talk to anybody. So this is kind of comes through very kind of loud and clear in the canon. And what tends to happen when we we shut off our speech and we shut off our kind of our usual things that we go out to look at, the people we go out to talk to, what we're left with then is just basically our minds, kind of just basically our own thoughts. And so what this gives us is an opportunity to see what they get up to, you know? Because oftentimes the thoughts that occur in our mind, the things that we're thinking, the way that our mind leads, these things are actually often invisible, very difficult to see. Yeah? And it's kind of like if we were outside in a, you know, a windstorm or something like that, and kind of lots of wind blowing. I know the other day it was you know, kind of very, very windy, and you could barely, you know, couldn't hear anything. There's sticks and trees. Actually, I went to record a video, and a tree fell down, not far from where I was. I got kind of worried. You know, it was this huge crack, and then this tree fell down. I was like, okay, well, dodged a bullet there. But in any event, when there's all this kind of wind outside, we can't hear kind of people next to us talking. Couldn't really hear the sounds of, like, the crickets, you know? Couldn't really even hear the sounds of the traffic, which was really loud. And this can be the way that our minds are. Kind of go out and get involved in a lot of things. It's necessary, you know. At work, you know, people might say things to us that are sound, you know, mean, or might be worrying about the next project to do, you know, might be thinking about, you know, what to do with the kids. And all these things are like kind of wind, you know, whipping up the leaves, whipping up the branches, you know, sometimes even, you know, causing a tree to fall nearby. I was like, what was that? But when these kind of things happen, we don't hear, we don't see the things that are subtle, the things that are right in front of us. And yet often it's the things that are subtle, the things that are in front of us that are kind of guiding our actions. And yet they're difficult to see. So in the same way, on a meditation retreat, when we close the doors to our usual sense faculties, when we close the doors to our usual modes of speech, when we close the doors to our usual modes of looking around at things, to watching TV, you know, to going out to movies, going out, what we're left with is the thoughts that are usually there in the background. And so the interesting thing about these thoughts is that they usually go unnoticed. Just for this reason, there's usually so much noise around. But the thing about these kind of subtle thoughts is they're actually the things that tend to guide our actions. They're actually the things that lead us to go out and run after the things that we love. They're the things that lead us to suffer. Lead us to suffer when we lose the things we love. And these things are there kind of operating subtly all the time. You don't get the chance to see them. So on a meditation retreat, this can come through clearly, you know, or more clearly. So we sit down to meditate, and you know, we're sitting there after the first hour, it's okay. Maybe after lunch, more meditation comes, and then we start to notice that there are pains in the body, kind of pains in the legs, you know, pains in the feet, pains in the hands, wherever it might be. And there's often two aspects to these kind of pains that occur in the body. On the one hand, if we've had a physical injury, then it's, you know, good to pay attention to, you know, not to injure our body, not to make our body more hurt than it needs to be. But there's also this very large aspect to the physical pains we feel in our body, which is a mental aspect. In other words, there's a lot of suffering that comes from physical pain just by this mind that we don't usually see going out to grab onto it, going out to complain about it. Oh, I can't take this. I can't take another minute. And this is the same mind that causes us to suffer all the time. Yeah? Also notice the same thing when various things can come up in a retreat. One of them is the temperature. So actually, I myself really like heat. You know, kind of love hot temperatures. If it was 30 degrees in here, I'd probably be really happy. But, you know, most people don't like that, so it's set colder. But regardless, almost certainly, there will be a time during the retreat when the temperature seems too hot or it seems too cold. And if this is our first retreat, these kind of thoughts can come up and they can seem completely overwhelming. Even this kind of hatred can come up towards maybe me, maybe towards the building. Oh, this is a terrible building. I can't take being in this building. It's too cold. Or, you know, there's not enough light coming through the shutters. All these kind of things. And of course, these aren't things that are going to kill us, right? Kind of course, you know, there's also two aspects to this. If the temperature was so freezing cold that it was, you know, 0 degrees and you're okay, we crank up the temperature. But I've set it to 19.5. And so there's enough people here, it should kind of warm up decently during the day and should be okay-ish. Yeah. So when our mind rushes out to whatever it might be, you know, whether it's to the physical pains in our body, whether it's to the cold, this is the exact same mind that's rushing out to things and causing us to suffer on the larger scale when we leave the retreat. So being here and closing all the doors to our sense faculties like this, what it gives us is actually a chance to combat these tendencies, to go against the grain of these tendencies. So I think oftentimes today, these days, meditation is presented as a form of kind of stress relief, stress reduction. And actually it does have that effect, you know, can kind of relieve our stress. But when we come to a retreat, it's kind of interesting because we can come with this expectation, oh, it's going to be this, you know, totally relaxing experience. And then we sit down and we find all this suffering coming up out of nowhere. Actually, I mean, some people might sit down and have a nice relaxing experience, not trying to say that that won't necessarily be the case, but just for the people who it's their first time, to prepare them for what might come up in the mind. The nice thing about this is that these things that cause us to suffer, this tendency of the mind to run out to grab on to minor things and make them major, run out to grab on to, you know, a problem like too cold, too hot, the person beside me breathing too loud, you know, the cushions aren't comfortable enough, whatever it might be. Whenever this comes up, this gives us a chance to go against the grain with this. You know, we learn to continue to come back to our meditation object over and over again. And in doing this, we create a new habit pattern. We create a new inclination for our mind. Normally, in day-to-day life, when the mind goes out, says, I'm hungry, get me something to eat, we can go out to the whatever it is, grab some food and eat it up. But here we have to wait till noon. Normally, when our mind says, I'm cold, I want more heat, we can go and turn on the thermostat and it'll come on right away. Normally, when our mind says, you know, I feel pain in my body, it's time to shift, we can shift here too, but we can get up and do whatever we want, right? We can leave, we can go to the movies, we can distract ourselves, but from 9 to 5 here, we're behaving like monks, so we can't do that. All we can do is watch our mind. All we can do is train it. But the nice thing about this is that when we learn to combat these tendencies, these same things that cause us to run out and grab these things in our worldly life, the same inclination of that mind, it gets diminished. So, you know, you might notice people sometimes feel furious about traffic, you know, feel furious when their kids do something wrong, you know, feel totally despondent when something that they love leaves them, when the person they love says something mean to them. This is that same inclination that's running out to say it's too hot, it's too cold, there's too much pain in my knee. So when we learn to counter this inclination, when we leave the retreat, sometimes we feel this great sense of relief. But this is actually only something that we can experience if we persevere through the difficulties in a retreat. Yeah? So actually, I was telling a story the other day. Actually, it was on Tuesday, I think, a Tuesday meditation, that my first retreat, I had absolutely no clue what I was getting into. You know, actually, I was going there and I thought to myself, well, you know, I hope this isn't too easy. Kind of thinking, well, you know, I hope I don't fall asleep too much. And so I remember going through this retreat and starting to feel some pain in my legs. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just fall asleep and I won't tell anybody, I'm going to cheat. And so I fell asleep for maybe 10 minutes and I woke up and the pain was worse. But I'd made this kind of determination that I wanted to sit on the floor the whole retreat and I didn't want to get beaten by that. And so I had to try everything, all the usual tricks that I could use in my worldly life, kind of shifting around. When I shifted around, I felt terrible, like, you know, shifted around out of this kind of restlessness, not out of any kind of physical need. I felt like I was disturbing other people, you know, didn't really, I just felt bad. Didn't feel like I was doing what was proper. And then, you know, everything I tried that I could usually try, there was no sensory stimulus for me to go out and watch TV. So I was just left there with my mind. And, you know, as they say, kind of necessity is the mother of invention. So when we're in these situations, this is when we learn how to find the things that actually lessen the pain, that actually lessen the suffering. Actually, we have no choice except to, you know, get up and leave. You know? But the wonderful thing about this is that when we persevere through these things, there actually comes a time when the difficulties that we are facing, they break. That's if we persevere. You know, this is kind of a principle, I think, even in nature. You know, when you read the great biographies of all these people who've done kind of wonderful things, they go through this terrible period of tribulation, and it seems like it's never going to end, and then somehow it breaks. It's all kind of over. Kind of just what was seemed so impossible, like it couldn't last another minute, just suddenly breaks. You know? So I remember I was telling people that I used to have this kind of terrible pain in my right knee whenever I would sit in meditation. And it went on, you know, I think it was maybe, yeah, during this kind of retreat. I went on a bunch of these kind of retreats. But it just keeps, these kind of things just keep going on, and they seem like they're never going to end. And it's day one, and there's like five more days or four more days to the retreat. But then the amazing thing is that suddenly, sometimes on the third day, whatever day it is, all the pain disappears. Just go to sit down one time, and it's just completely gone. It's like, what happened there? You know? So this is something that we can learn directly, you know? Because oftentimes we trust our thoughts, right? It's kind of this thought comes up in my head, this person did this terrible thing to me, you know, I can't, you know, I can't take it, you know, this thought comes up in our head, you know, this is going to be impossible for me to accomplish, you know, I'm never going to do it, you know. These kind of thoughts come up all the time, or, you know, the future is going to be something terrible, you know. And when they come up in our mind, we tend to think, this is my thought, this is rational, this is true, I'm going to believe it. But what we learn on a retreat when we keep sitting, when we persevere through these things, when we see the way that our mind moves, is that actually oftentimes our mind is lying to us. It's not telling us the truth. We can't just trust whatever thought comes up into our head that it's a good thought, whatever perception comes up into our head that it's a good perception. We've got to learn to evaluate these things, you know, whether or not they're good. And so it's kind of like if we were sitting on the side of the road, you know, and somebody pulled up and said, hey, get in my car. Right? Usually when a person just follows their thoughts all the time, it's like somebody pulls up and says, get in my car. I don't know who you are, but yeah, sure, I'll get in. Maybe I've got an important meeting right now, but yeah, I'll hop in, take a ride. And yeah, maybe that person will drive you to your meeting, but maybe they're a Hell's Angel. And they're going to take you to a place that's no good. Have to kind of jump out of the car and roll. And so our thoughts are like this, right? On a retreat, this kind of memory can come up that seems so tantalizing. You know, kind of, you know, this great memory. You know, I had this wonderful memory when I was young. Okay, here's my meditation topic, but I've got this great memory. Right? And when that memory comes up, we grab onto it, we jump into it, and we're there, and everything is wonderful. We're, you know, young kids again, playing in the yard, or we're meeting our old friend again for the time that we haven't seen them for a while, and it's all good. And it stays that way for maybe a few minutes, 3, 4, 5 minutes, but then eventually we start thinking, oh, geez, I really miss this person. It'd be great to see them. Or then we remember some fight that we had with that person, or something else happens. Yeah. And so this is just like jumping into these kind of cars, and kind of these thought worlds that come up. They seem tantalizing, but we don't know where they're going to lead us. You know? And these are the thought worlds, these are the kind of cars, these are the kind of vehicles that oftentimes it's so easy to jump into in our daily life. So on a meditation retreat, we learn to restrain ourselves. We learn to evaluate every vehicle that comes by, every thought that comes by. Is this a thought that's related to my meditation? Is this a thought that's related to improving my concentration? Is this a thought that's related to abandoning my defilements? If it isn't, then we don't follow it. It's like if somebody were to pull up in a car and say, hey, come on, get in my car. And instead of jumping in right away, we ask them, so wait a minute, who are you? Are you a cab? You know, where do you want to take me? And if they can't give a good answer, then we don't get in. I'll just walk instead. Just keep kind of going on my way. You know? And what this tends to do is it keeps us safe, because jumping into these thought worlds, jumping into these cars, can take us very far from our destination. Can take us over to, you know, Toronto Island, can take us over to Montreal. Sometimes we jump into a thought world that takes us across the planet, over to Africa, you know. There's kind of a really good verse in the canon where the Buddha says, you know, the mind is nimble, hard to hold down. You know, he says more. Another verse he says, kind of dwelling in a cave, bodiless, going wherever it likes. Taming it is good, because the tame mind brings ease. So in the same way, these things that seem so desiring, seem like they're great to jump into, seem like they're great to run after, the tricky thing about them is that they're like these kind of temptations that, you know, like a nice candy bar, right? Kind of grab the candy bar and eat it, and it tastes really good, and it seems like that great thing will never end, but the second candy bar doesn't taste so great. And the third tastes even doesn't taste as good either. But somehow we develop an addiction to these kind of candy bars. Keep eating them, you somehow can't stop eating candy bars. You know, even though we know, look, this candy bar, I can't keep eating junk food like this. It's causing me to suffer. You know, it's making my body unhealthy. But somehow this kind of addiction comes, keep eating them, keep eating them. You know. So when we come to a meditation retreat, what we're learning to do is step back from this kind of addictive mind, this mind that doesn't see the long-term consequences of its actions, the mind that's kind of nimble, the mind that's hard to hold down, the mind that's bodiless, dwelling in a cave, going wherever it likes. This is the same mind that doesn't respond when a bad situation comes up in our life, we're suffering, and we say, look, I don't want to do this. It says, well, hey, I've been doing whatever I like for so long, so try to stop me. So here what we learn to do is train our mind. That's why the Buddha says the mind well trained brings ease. And training our mind is a little bit like training an animal, training anything else. We have to keep it on a leash, you know. Can't just let it go smelling whatever it likes. Can't just let it go eating whatever it likes. And here this leash is our meditation topic. Here this leash, if we've never meditated before, I'll give some instruction on breath meditation, can be breath meditation. Or if we've done many retreats before, we've meditated a lot before, it can be whatever topic you like. We yoke our mind to this topic. And this is where that kind of word yoga comes from. It's why meditators are called yogis. Okay? They yoke their mind to a topic. Don't let it go wherever it likes. Mm-hmm. So the nice thing about this, of course, is we've just been talking about the negative side of following our thoughts. But there are many positive sides. There are many kind of benefits to training the mind in meditation. It's not just like it's a terrible, rough slog, you know, all along. You know? And this graph's the same way. When a person is eating candy bars all the time, eating junk food all the time, eating these kind of things all the time, it's very difficult for them to see the benefits that come from eating healthy food, from constantly exercising. But when we see somebody who's exercising, eating healthy food, they don't look like a miserable person, right? It's not like their life is terrible, you know, exercising and eating healthy food. Actually, they, you know, their bodies feel very good. They feel very kind of strong, able to do many things. And when they eat junk food, even to them, it tastes terrible, you know? And so the same thing can happen when we train our mind. These kind of thoughts that seem so tantalizing to run after, the thoughts about, oh, you know, I really love this. I want to do this right now, you know. Oh, this person was terrible to me. If I just go yell at them, it would be great. These kind of thoughts are like this kind of junk food. And when we stop eating junk food for the first time, when we start eating healthy food for the first time, it won't necessarily taste the greatest right away. Won't be like the first time we sit down to, or first time we eat a healthy meal. If we've been eating junk food for a while, all of a sudden our bodies become strong. We're like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce Lee, right? Kind of won't be like that, right? It's not really the way it works. Actually, when a person's been eating a lot of junk food, first time they eat healthy food, it doesn't taste good. First time they exercise, it might not feel all that great. Their body's trying to expel all the kind of junk that's in there, you know? So I remember I used to smoke when I was young. And remember kind of trying to quit smoking. And every morning when you smoke, if you stop smoking, when you're smoking a lot, it doesn't happen. But when you stop smoking, you start coughing. Just cough up all this, you know, phlegm, you know, you're coughing. Sometimes you get sick. Sometimes the parts of your lungs that you've kind of coughed stuff up from, they're very sensitive. And if you're kind of, it's like a changing season, bacteria come in, you get sick. And so it seems like, geez, I'm getting worse here. You know, if I just smoked again, my lungs would be nice and coated and no problems, right? But the nice thing is that persevering and not smoking, gradually the time comes when you notice, hey, my lungs are feeling a lot better than they did before. You know, hey, you know, I'm actually able to run and not wheeze. I'm actually able to climb steps. You know, my body feels a lot stronger. And then after a while, if you completely stop smoking, even the smell of smoke becomes something that is kind of disgusting. You kind of don't like it anymore. And our mind operates the same way with these thought patterns, you know? These kind of negative thoughts, these kind of thoughts of harming, these thoughts of rushing out to consume, food or pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, these thoughts of hatred, this person did this bad thing to me, I'm going to get them, or these kind of thoughts of harming. Actually, this is what most of TV is. This is what most of comedy is. Kind of comedy, most of the time, is people doing something really mean to somebody else or having something really terrible happen to them. I remember I used to watch it, not to get down, I'm not trying to stop anybody from watching comic TV shows, but I used to watch Dave Chappelle before I became a monk. He was very funny, kind of hilarious guy. But actually, most of the skits in that are, people having really bad things happen to them, and it's really funny. Kind of this person slips and there's kind of blooper, or he would make a lot of kind of ethnic jokes. They'd be joking about people's ethnicities and kind of, people, their various ethnicities, they'd be doing these silly things. And of course, if you're that ethnicity, it feels terrible. Or if you're the guy who slipped, it feels terrible. But rushing out to consume these things seems great. These kind of thoughts are harming. Kind of same with thoughts of what they call kamatanha, these kind of pleasant things, these thoughts of, I want this burger, I want this next car, I want this next house. I want my kids to behave themselves and, not do these things. And of course, some of these things are legitimate. These are, again, things where there's two sides to it. But the thing about these things is that when we rush out to eat them, we rush out to consume them, it's like eating this junk food. We eat it and it becomes a part of ourselves. These kind of thoughts become a habit pattern in our mind, and then we take this kind of habit pattern to be who we really are. I am my kids. I am my house. I am my car. I am, a person who, who's really funny or whatever. And the tricky thing about these things, when we rush out to consume them, when we don't have them, we suffer. When they change, we suffer. So what we're learning to do on a meditation retreat is to take our mind away from all these things. We learn to evaluate our thoughts. We learn to see whether it's a good ride to get into. We learn to take our minds away from these kind of candy bars, these things that seem tantalizing, but that we know will hurt us in the long run. We learn to train our mind. We learn to train our mind the same way we train an animal. Bit by bit, we have a leash. We yoke it to the leash. And the benefits that come from this is that gradually, we learn to develop a refuge. We learn to develop a sense of stability that isn't dependent on these kind of things our mind usually rushes out to consume. It isn't dependent on our car. It isn't dependent on our house. It isn't dependent on our children. It isn't dependent on our job. What it is dependent on is us training our mind, us finding delight in learning to think wholesome thoughts, us finding delight in learning to come back to our meditation topic. And when we do this, kind of very positive things can arise. Because oftentimes the things that cause us to fly off the handle, the things that cause us to suffer, they're the very things that we're consuming all the time. So when we have a meditation practice that becomes consistent, that we do all the time, we notice for ourselves. When that person cut me off, I used to get angry. Now I don't get angry anymore. Why is that? When my child, I used to have this terrible anxiety about their future, and that seems not to come up as much. Why is that? All of it is because we're taking our mind away from these thought worlds. We're taking our mind away from the junk food. We're not just hopping into the cars all the time. And when we do this consistently, the amazing thing that happens is the Buddha says that, bhikkhus, this mind is radiant. It's defiled by defilements that come. That's kind of a very loose translation. I'm very bad at remembering exact sutta translations, but that's the rough idea. And the thing about this, he doesn't say the mind is pure. So this radiance is in ourself. But when we learn to come back to our meditation topic all the time, when our mind isn't rushing out to grab onto these things that obscure it, the mind starts to become bright. Mind starts to become peaceful. We start to experience a kind of sense of ease for ourselves, an ease in our life that's special, kind of sense of ease that we've never experienced before, kind of separate kind of pleasure, separate kind of happiness. And these are what the Buddha calls the happinesses of the jhanas. Kind of, it's the word jhana in Pali. So these are things that we're trying to cultivate. You know? But all these things are things that we can only know for ourselves. You know? So although I'm here, you know, at the center, you know, I'm kind of guiding this retreat, which basically means, I'm ringing the bell, but I forgot to put a bell out. I'll just say when it's done, and giving talks. But all of us are actually here, more or less. We're here together, but we're also here alone. So I actually don't know what's going on in all of your minds. I can't be there to tell you what to do when each car pulls up. I can't be there to tell you if it's a good one to get into. A retreat leader can do things like tell you, cars that are good look like this. They've got a taxi cab sign. Ask them where you want to go. But when it pulls up, we're all there alone to train ourselves alone. And this is why the Buddha says that we're the heir to our karma. We're born of our karma. We're related to our karma. We abide supported by our karma. Because all of us make this karma for ourselves. We make these decisions for ourselves. You know? So as long as we learn to train our mind, as long as we come here and each individually learn to come back to our topics of meditation, then we get to experience for ourselves some of what the Buddha talked about. You know? Actually, there are the teachings that are in the text, and these are very important. You know? The suttas give us an excellent guide. You know, they're a very excellent guide. Actually, when the Buddha's teachings are extremely clear, he takes something that's very, very complicated and makes it look simple. Makes it look real simple. His explanations leave almost no ambiguity a lot of the time, or you know, almost no room to doubt what he's talking about. But the thing about these explanations, the thing about the suttas is they're the Buddha's knowledge. They are not our knowledge yet. You know? So they only become our knowledge if we make them our knowledge. So the Buddha was a helpful teacher in the sense that he pointed the way. He can't reach into our minds and train them for us. He can't make us happy. You know, other things outside of ourselves can't somehow just make us happy, make us skillful. They can influence us, but they can't make the decisions for us. So when we come to meditate, what we actually learn is what the Buddha was really talking about. When he talks about the mind that's hard to train, that's nimble, that's hard to hold down, we see that mind for ourselves. We see it rushing out to grab on to the heat, to the cold. We see it rushing out to worry about what we're going to do after the retreat. We see it rushing out to the memory that seems so pleasant, that we just want to dwell in. We see it rushing out to the sleepiness. We see it rushing out to whatever it is. And this is where we see what the Buddha means when he says to train the mind. This is where we really learn what it means to train our minds. This is a knowledge that's ours, that's outside of the suttas. It's in our own experience. So this is where the Buddha's teachings really lie. This is why he said, I can't remember the actual story in the sutta, but there was a person, and maybe somebody would correct me if I'm wrong, but there was I might be getting two suttas confused here, but there was one, I think it was a Brahmin, he said to the Buddha, you know, there are these kind of Brahmins in town, I can't remember the name of it, and he said, you know, they can, through their kind of chanting, through their mantras, they can raise up people who are going to hell and make them go to heaven, you know? And he said, but the Buddha, you know, you can make everybody attain Nibbana. And the Buddha says in this particular sutta, yeah, this is too. He says, well, in that case, Brahmin, I'll question you. He says, if a person were to throw a heavy stone into a lake and a large crowd of people were to come and chant and say, rise up, stone, we want you to rise up. Would the stone rise up? And the Brahmin says, no. And the Buddha says, in the same way, you know, if a person does bad actions, if they think bad thoughts, they'll sink. And then he says, if somebody were to take some oil and throw it onto the pond or the lake, and a large crowd of people were to say, sink down oil, he says, what do you think? Would the oil sink down? And then the Buddha says, the person says no. And the Buddha says, in the same way, if a person does good actions, they cultivate good thoughts. Basically, they learn to train their mind, even though a whole bunch of people might wish that they not be happy, that person will rise up. And then the second sutta, I can't remember the preamble to this one, but there's a person who comes along and he says something. I think he asked the Buddha why the people, whether everybody he's going to train will attain enlightenment. And the Buddha says, in that case, Brahman, I'll question you. He says, suppose there were a man standing at a crossroads and another person came up to ask them directions. And they said, which is the way to Rajagaha? And the Buddha says, okay, you go this way, take a right, take a left, and then, I'm paraphrasing here, and then you'll be at Rajagaha. And then that man, having received those instructions, goes walking, but then heads off and goes wherever he likes. He says, what do you think? Would the person who gave directions be able to do anything? And the man says, no, that person only points the way. And so the Buddha says, in the same way, Tathagatas only point the way. In essence, it's up for us to walk the path ourselves. And so this is what we're here to do today. We're here to walk the Buddha's path. We're here to bring our minds back. We're here to stop them from running around. And we're here to learn what he really means when he says, the mind well trained brings ease. But this requires something of us. It requires us to persevere. It requires us to pull our minds back ourselves. And when we do this consistently on this retreat, day by day, our happiness increases. And when this happens, those thoughts that seemed so tantalizing before, they're like the candy bar. They're like the cigarette to the person who stopped smoking. Even the smell of them, even the look of them, seems like something we don't want to touch anymore. And when we learn to train our minds this way, our mind inclines towards happiness, our mind inclines towards peace, then this is where we really gain in the Buddha's teachings. This is where we get a knowledge that's independent from the suttas. This is where we get a knowledge that's independent from other people. And this is where we learn what the Buddha means when he says, become an island unto yourself, become a refuge unto yourself, be a lamp unto yourself. So we learn to be that way. We learn to become an island the floods can't overwhelm.